Blind people still have a sense of seeing things. Okay? Your ear is the organ of hearing, but your mind is the sense of hearing. People have a sense of hearing something. We have these sensibilities. Okay? And they are in the mind. The body is the organ to communicate outside external world things whereby the mind senses these through the body. But there's a lot of things you sense that's not through the physical body, the material body. The sinner, one who lives contrary to the law of God, has chosen to sin? No. Has chosen to make his sensibilities, his flesh, what he wants, what he feels, his passions, his sensations, his emotions, his pain, his pleasure, to make those the object for which will control his life, for which he'll either ignore, he'll ignore pain, or he'll indulge in pleasure. He'll pursue the passions of having those passions again that he got so much pleasure out of. The will has consented to make these the object of pursuit above every other consideration, including God's infinite considerations and interests. The saint, one who is dead in Christ and alive unto God, has been persuaded, if he had been a sinner before, and I assume all people have been, the change that occurs is that he has been induced and persuaded to look at the truth that he hears and perceives in his intellect and his reason, to look at it and view the evidence and consent to conform and submit to the evidence. And the evidence is that there is a creator, Romans 1. There's a creator. Through creation, he's revealed. He has revealed his divine attributes and his Godhead, eternal powers, which is sufficient reason for the mind to have to contemplate. I know I didn't create the world. I know you didn't create the world. I don't believe anybody here created the world. I don't believe anybody on this planet created the world. And I don't believe that this world created itself, because every cause has an effect, and that's the first truth. And, every event has a cause, and every cause has an effect. And this world is an effect of something. It's not a cause of something. Because if this world were a cause of something, it would be eternal. We can see evidences that it's not eternal, that it is decaying all around us, and that's not an attribute of being eternal. So it must have had a start, and that must therefore had a cause. That cause must be greater than the effect. So there must be some kind of being out there that is greater than me or all that I see. That knowledge imposes the obligation to find out if that being, who must be greater, has anything to do with me. It's like you're living on an island out in the Pacific. One morning you wake up in your cave, and you come out, at the entrance of your cave, there's this breakfast sitting there on a tray. You sit down, you eat it. What are you going to do? That breakfast, showing up there when you think there's nobody else on the island, obligates you to find out if you owe that person at least your gratitude. Because you know it did not just happen. Therefore, it imposes the obligation. And I'll show you the significance of this. Okay, that illustration?
Yeah.
Okay. You live on an island in the Pacific. There's nobody else on that island. You live in a cave. You come out in the morning and breakfast is sitting there on a tray. It is undeniable to your mind that that did not create itself. You know you didn't prepare breakfast. So somebody who prepared breakfast deserves your gratitude at least. It must be somebody on the island. It didn't come on its own. That creates the necessary obligation of the mind. That creates knowledge that there's another being somewhere. You follow? You see that? Okay. That knowledge that there's another being imposes obligation upon you to relate to him in a certain way. Either you will go and give him your thanks, or you will ignore him. But you cannot remain neutral. Knowledge that there are other moral beings around you forces you to decide, I will treat this person this way, or I will not. I will either seek my interest first, or I will give them the due regard to their interests, which I know that they deserve and I owe them. But you can't remain neutral when people are around you. You're forced to decide what kind of relationship you will have, and you will either love them as yourself or you will not. We're getting, and I'll pull that together in a moment, but do you see the illustration? Okay. Some people say that is sin. Having sensations and feelings and desires and passions and pain is sinful. Just having those is sinful. Just having a nature that has those is sinful, some people say. These are neither sinful, and they're not virtuous. This is where the great desire to love God and obey Him exists and abides, in the sensibilities. There's no virtue in that. There's no sin in desires, in and of themselves. Feelings and passions and such. There's no sin in them. As long as the will is devoted not to follow them and make it its rule of action, but as long as the will is devoted to the truth and giving interest their proper relationship and values, he will not indulge these for their own sake. Cannot. But when the will is committed to make these the rule of action, that whenever somebody feels something, that's when they act. Whenever they want something, that's when they act. Whenever they try to avoid something, that's when they act. When that becomes the rule of action, instead of the moral law through the reason, that's a state of transgression and a state of sin. The will committed to act only under that rule of action is a state of selfishness and a state of sin. It has nothing to do with the actions one takes afterwards to fulfill and indulge. Just being committed to that as a rule of action is a sinful state. Sin is much worse than actions, as probably most of you know. It is being in this state. In this state. Being in this state, but hearing the law, produces Romans 7. Being committed to follow the sensibilities as a rule of action, your rule for living. But hearing the moral law revived and brought out through hearing the moral law, and the conscience awakens, the Holy Spirit works upon the individual through the moral law and hearing the law. They get awakened, they see its glory, they see its goodness, they see its holiness. They want to follow it, but they do not find within them the willingness to follow it, even though they want to follow it. That's Romans 7, is it not? Knowing what to do and doing it not, sin. Romans 7. Oh, I really want to do the law. I really want to love God with all my heart. I really want to stop coveting. That's created desires, knowledge of the law, but the heart still committed. As this is a rule of action. So they will sense their condemnation, because the conscience is saying, you know what you ought to do, but you're not doing it. And there's the conscience condemning. Holy Spirit comes along and illumines the law and the reason and wakes up the conscience. Now there's not only condemnation, but there's conviction. Conviction of the true nature of sin, which is this commitment contrary to what the law commands. It is the reason that perceives the truth of God and the law. The gospel comes and appeals to the reason and gives the will another object of choice than the sensibilities or the law. So we have, as moral agents, to be a moral agent, you must have intellect in order to understand your obligation. You must have a will in order to choose to fulfill your obligation. And you must have sensibilities. They're a necessary part. They're not sinful. They're a necessary part of being a moral agent. But they're not sinful. Why are they necessary? Because without our sensibilities, Without our sensibilities, we would have no sense of what it means to be in a state of well-being. We would have no sense of what is good. How can I promote your good? How can I love you and promote what would be good for you equally with what would be good for me if I didn't know what good was? Where do I get this idea of what's good? I get it through my sensibilities. My sensibilities inform me and develop the idea within my reason, through my experiences of my sensibilities. It develops the idea that some things are good and some things are not. So that I gain knowledge of things that are good for me and good for all moral beings. I gain an idea of what is good, so that if I'm going to promote good for another, I have an idea of what it is. How could you do it without an idea of what it is? And that idea is developed through the sensibilities. Wonderful faculty. Not sinful. Not to be despised, just not to be obeyed. That's all. They're not to be the rule of action or the object of that which we obey, but they inform us. This is a wonderful world to live in. There's so much good in this world. God made everything good. I heard that once. You know, God said it is good, right? He meant it. This is a wonderful world. Everything in this world has such wonderful good to it. I might not eat fire, but there's such good that can come out of using fire. But there's so many wonderful things in this world that are personally good to me, either directly upon my being or my usages of it. Everything God has made is good, not to be despised. It's just not to be the object of our devotion and love and pursuit and obedience. We're not to take the created thing and worship it as if it were the Creator. We're not to love the creature more than the Creator. So now, I've got three things in my being that qualify me for a moral agent. I need one more thing to be subject to the moral law. We've suggested it on here already, but it is distinct from our own being and something that we need. And I may not be clear on that, so I'll just tell you. You have to have these three faculties, intellect, sensibilities, and will, to be a moral agent. If somebody does not have all three of those functioning properly, if you destroy somebody's reason through drugs, they're no longer a moral agent. They're no longer subject to the moral law because they do not have any comprehension of what they ought to pursue. Now, don't go destroy your mental capabilities thinking you'll get rid of your obligation or your liability under sin, because if a person destroys their mental capabilities, from that point on, they're not subject to the moral law, but they are responsible for the act that destroyed their abilities. Okay? We need one more thing. We've talked about it. A necessary condition for moral obligation is light, knowledge. Knowledge of the truth. Knowledge of what is good. Knowledge of obligation. Light, truth. Paul says in Romans chapter 1, a great deal of that, sufficient amount comes to that through creation to put all men under obligation. There's sufficient light through creation. That is why the heathen go to hell. Not because they deny Jesus Christ, refuse the gospel. They go to hell because they transgress the law. And they go to hell because they had enough light from creation to know what they ought to have done. People go to hell because they refuse to do what they ought to have done, not because they reject Jesus Christ. They go to hell for disobedience. They go to heaven through faith. Okay? That's what it takes to be a moral agent, responsible and subject to the moral law. I'm going to throw one other additional thing in here that had to do with the illustration. Yes?
I don't know if this is a tangent or not, but can the heathen, without Jesus Christ, can they make the decision that they know what they're supposed to do? Can they decide to be doing what they're supposed to do?
Yes, they can.
They go to heaven?
No, they can't. Let me answer the question as the way I saw you asking it. Here's what I understand the question to be. Can a heathen who has not, from the moment of understanding his obligation through creation, who has not followed it, come to an understanding of what he ought to do, think about it for a couple of years, and decide to obey because he can, and therefore go to heaven? Question? No. Because he needs to have his sins atoned for that he's committed already. Returning to obedience does not give you salvation. That's what's owed God all along. And it does not, here, obedience from here throughout eternity does not atone for your sins. But people think that the teaching is that, well, since man can obey, and if he hears he ought to obey, you know, when he's 30 years old and he's not obeyed for 30 years or 25 years, whatever the number of is, if he starts obeying now because he can, he'll get saved. No. Because his obedience is not an atonement. Okay. That it is kind of an atonement?
No, that when you come to that point of acknowledgement of sinful state, that just acknowledgement of that and then not doing it any further atones for it.
Okay. So that doesn't do it, see? Why? Because that obedience is what you owe God all along. Here's one of the wonderful things of this moral law. The moral law commands that you promote God's interest with your whole heart, all your heart. Are you able to give him all your heart, mind, soul, and strength? Don't you have control of all your heart, mind, soul, and strength? Yes. Can you love God with more than all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength? Okay? So if, in obeying the law, which I like to use the term loving God instead of obeying the law, because if you say, well, in love, obeying the law, it fixes people's minds on, that's what I'm supposed to do is obey the law. No. You're supposed to love God, and that is obedience to the law, but you're supposed to love God. So in loving God with all your heart, and since you can't love him with more than all your heart, then you can't do something more than what you owe him right now, here, which can't make up for the past. There's no... Anybody know the term supererogation? Philosophical term? There is no merit. There is no additional merit produced by present obedience. You can't love God with all your heart plus 10% and gradually throw that 10% back into here and fill it up, make up for it. It's a lost cause. Once sin occurs, it's a lost cause in terms of law and obedience. That is why nobody is saved by law, because it's a lost cause. Present and future obedience does not pump into the past. This is the Roman Catholic teaching, is it not? The merit of the saints, the merits of Mary, merits of Jesus, all pump into your deficiency to make up for it. And it produces a sufficient amount of merit to make up for it. And there's no grace in that, no mercy in that. So, any kind of system that would pump into here a righteousness to make up for sin is appealing to justice.
Yeah. Is it possible to not have that circle in the middle? Or a heathen who has not heard of Jesus Christ to not have that circle in the middle? So the moment he has that choice, he has free will for him to choose God's way and God's law and for him to love.
It has to be the possibility, otherwise it wouldn't be sin. Paul in Romans chapter 1 and 2 clearly builds his case for what sin is upon the possibility that the heathen, if they had followed the light that they had, would not be condemned in their conscience nor by God on judgment day. But because they have not is why all have sinned. Yes?
Yeah, that's why I was going to ask, like you said, light is one of the things that's required, like free will, intellect, sensibility, light is required. But light is inherent, period. No mean it's without it. Everybody has light, regardless, so you're accountable to answer to that light.
Yes. That's what
everybody has a conscience, whether he's a heathen in Africa that never heard of Jesus or whatever, he has that light, right?
Paul, if you look at Romans 1 and 2, his whole argument to prove Romans 3:23, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, his whole argument is based not on Romans 5. His whole argument is summed up in Romans 1 and 2, that all men, under the light of nature and through the conscience, have sufficient light to guide them in their obligation, and therefore they could have the possibility to obey. That's why they're accountable, because they could have done otherwise. You know what's the proof that somebody is a moral agent? That they have light, that they have all the qualities of moral agency. You know what the proof is? Pointing the finger. That person shouldn't do that. You know what that proves? They know what a person should do. They have knowledge of it. The conscience is working to affirm that that's not what a person should do. They have a sense of what a person should do. You take a child, Mommy, look what they're doing. They shouldn't do that. That child has moral agency and understanding. Isn't that interesting? Pointing the finger affirms that a person knows and is accountable. I've had people say to me, who are not believers, who are not professing Christians, all those Christians, look at Jimmy Swaggart, look at those people, they don't live like Christians should. And I've sat down with that person and said, you know what? That comment, you know what that proves? You know what? That you know how a Christian should live, and therefore you're under obligation to live as one. The Bible says that the law shuts the mouth. It does. To their own, they've condemned themselves when they pointed the finger. They know that's how a person should live. The law is not for Christians only. The law is for all men, all moral agents. The law, the moral law, is for every moral agent on the face of this earth and in heaven and in God's kingdom, wherever it might be. So it's not as though the law all of a sudden raises up and imposes the Christian to love God, but the sinner is not obligated to. He's obligated to as well. That's why he's convicted. Okay, good questions. Let's look at more what the law the law commands. What does the law command? That we love God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love our neighbor as ourselves. You can tell me what love is. You ever hear that as a teenager? What is love, student? I'm sitting there going, and you believe, you're led to believe that nobody knows. And they're right. Nobody really knows except those to whom the love of God has been shed abroad in the heart. John?
Seeking the benefit, best interest in the object loved.
Okay. Seeking the best interest of the object loved. Okay. Anybody else want to add, express it differently?
Committal of the will to seek the higher good.
Committal of the will to seek the highest good. Okay? Seek, practice. Okay. Anybody else want to define love? Is it a feeling? Is it a desire? Does it consist merely in feelings and merely in desires? Excuse me?
Love what you do.
Love is what you do. He did get.
It's not a feeling.
Okay, not a feeling. He's action oriented down here. Anybody else?
The valuing of the object love greater than anything else.
Excuse me?
The valuing of the object love greater than anything
else. The valuing of the object loved is greater than any other? Is that what you're saying? What you're offering? Okay. Does that hold? If I love my wife, should I value her greater than anybody else? That would kind of fall apart on that, wouldn't it? Because she's my neighbor and you're my neighbor. Aren't you supposed to love your wife more than anybody else?
Well, I'm somewhat agree that there are different values and value-oriented love, too.
It is a value-oriented... I agree that it's a value-oriented, that is an estimation of the proper value of the object to be loved, and its interest, like I've been talking about earlier. God's interests are infinite, mine are not. De facto, I have to make a distinction between the value of the interests of God and the value of my interests. Now understand, I'm not saying the value of God and the value of me. I'm not saying that, and understand that. Love is not valuing a person as they should be. It is placing the proper value on their well-being. There's a big difference. Anybody see the difference? Because your well-being is what's valuable, you're not. Now, don't misunderstand me. You're valuable. But that's not what the moral law is addressing. The moral law is seeking to promote the greatest well-being or good in the universe. Moral agents are the only beings capable of enjoying good or well-being. Okay? Enjoying happiness.
Example would be like spanking a child.
Well, hold on a minute. Let me work on my own mind here. Your happiness has a value to it. You do too, but the moral law is interested in your happiness that you can experience and be in rather than you. And maybe in your mind you can't separate, and that's okay if you can understand my distinctions. So that I am concerned about promoting your well-being, and I am to estimate how important your happiness is in consideration of my own and God's, and make my distinctions of my objects based upon a true evaluation of the value of the happiness of those objects, the well-being of those objects.
I think to make that a little shorter, I think you have to think about your obligation. You're talking about an obligation to love here, and we have an obligation to love, but our relational obligation is different to ones that we know than it is to ones that we don't know.
Okay, we'll make that distinction real soon here. That the moral law is addressing one thing and the means and the carrying out is different. I cannot promote the good of somebody over in Africa, but I can promote yours. Therefore, because of the relationship we have, I can actually execute my end. I can actually carry it out. I can actually promote your well-being because I have access to you. Today we have a relationship of one day. We have certain things going on between us. I'm obligated to promote your good to the best of my understanding and ability. I'm devoted to that. And after today, I won't have that ability. I'll lose the ability to actually do the good that I intend to do. It'll be done. But when you go back home, you've got the relations of wives, family, spouses, in-laws, outlaws, all of that, church, employer, employee. Those relations are a necessary condition to carrying out intent. And there's a distinction between the intent, the ultimate end intent, and the carrying out of the means to actually fulfill the intent. Okay?
Yes. This goes off the tangent, okay. It's very difficult for me to make this thing.
Okay.
The value and the well-being. I'm not clear on that.
Okay. Can we try to talk about it at break? Sure. And if it's a big problem, then I'll cover it again. Okay, thank you. Here's my definition. It's similar to some that have been given. It's the commitment to promote the well-being of another for its own sake. Got to throw in this aspect here, for its own sake. That's what I have written down as a definition of love. Yes.
Shouldn't we mention it before I'm really thinking, according to its proper value in the scheme of things?
Yes. Yes. That comes in remarks or development. But as a working definition, it's a commitment. Working definition of what would exist in a being if they were conformed to the law. Okay? That is, there would exist the commitment to promote the well-being of another for its own sake.
Love itself and the manifestations of love. I mean, some of these guys are answering the question, well, if I, shouldn't I define the relative value of somebody, and isn't my love going to change then? But love itself won't change, but the manifestation will take on different forms in different relationships.
Yes, I agree. Thank you. Maybe you... We can... Thank you. In the breaks or this evening, question and answer, if those things are a sticker still, then work on those. Okay? Thank you. For its own sake, what does that mean to your understanding? What is for its own sake? Anybody know another word that says for its own sake? Disinterestedness? Intrinsic comes into play. This part is disinterested. This part is the benevolent. Benevolence simply means good, willing. Willing, but good, disinterestedly. Disinterested benevolence. Not that there's lack of interest, there's great interest, but the interest is not mine that I work on. It's the well-being of another, interest of another. Benevolence, disinterested benevolence. It must be disinterested before it can be love. If it's not disinterested, it's not love. As the Bible, as the moral law, as God's character is. God is totally disinterested, not uninterested. He's keenly interested, but he does nothing for his own sake. No self-interest. All of his interests are according to the proper value of the interest. You know what is the supreme, most valuable interest in the universe? God's well-being. Thank you. That is why he seeks it. Not because it's his, but it is because it is the greatest, most valuable interest. Stay with us, folks. Keep coming back. Anybody that might have puzzles, keep coming back. Stay with us. You're doing fine. Hold on, Paul. Okay. Is the commitment, here's a distinction, not to be willing that it should happen. Love is not the commitment to be willing that other people promote the well-being of another, or that God do it. It is the commitment my in the ruling of government, and is dissatisfied when government people have an interest, personal, in what they do in government. Do we not? Whole governments are thrown out when possible because they are personally interested and not disinterested. They are not interested in the public good, but they are using the public good for private purposes. That's interestedness. That's an ulterior motive. Love has no use of the public good for personal interest. Personal interest is not superior and supreme, but the public good is what is concerned in love. The public good, the good of others, the greatest good. Is that not what Christ came to do? To secure the good of those who needed it and could not secure it themselves? Was he not interested in the great wealth of the kingdom of God being secured and promoted than just his own? Certainly. That's the spirit of the law. That's the spirit of the law. It's totally disinterested, not seeking its own. 1 Corinthians 13. Love does not seek its own. Love does not, period, seek its own. Seeking something else other than its own. It's seeking yours, it's seeking his, but it's not seeking its own. That's my working definition of it as I constructed this to have an alternative to simply saying disinterested benevolence, because that is not self-explanatory in our time. It was 150 years ago in the discussions of theology. It was well known. Disinterested benevolence, no problem. But to our minds, we've not developed along that line. So, benevolence is good willing, which means the will is involved, to be committed, commit the whole being to good or well-being of another disinterestedly. That's what love is. Now look at the book of Luke, chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. Let us all read out loud, whatever version you have. Just don't read it louder than anybody else and we'll be okay. I'm reading the New American Standard. Luke 6, beginning with verse 27 down through verse 36. Everyone out loud. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also. And whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. And just as you want people to treat you, treat them in the same way. And if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He Himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. What do you see in there that Jesus is talking about that would give us attributes of love, including what we've just gone through, and mostly what we've just gone through? Do you see disinterestedness in there expressed? John, do you see it somewhere?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
A few places.
Okay.
Because he says, even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Don't do good to them just because they're going to do good back to you or because they did good to you.
Okay. So the motive would not be, gee, they did me a favor, I should do them a favor. Okay. It would not be them. Anybody else? The other things in there? Other examples of disinterestedness? Anybody else? What verse is in that? 30. What is that verse describing? What's the attribute that verse is describing? It's not disinterestedness, though these are very close to each other, but it's describing something else.
Impartiality.
Impartiality. Do not make a distinction in the person in your treatment of them. Treat everyone as if they were the same person. The word partiality means receiving one's face. That's the word. That's what the word means in the Greek. God is not impartial. God does not receive one's face. He does not look on the outward appearance. He looks on the heart. He does not take into account the position. Bless God, He doesn't take into account the gender, the height, the weight, the nationality, anything. He is not partial in regards to any distinction other than the fact that they are moral agents. And He treats them all the same. That is, seeking their good. Now, let me make a distinction for you. Impartiality and equality is not the same thing. Equal treatment and impartial treatment is not the same thing. And let me illustrate, because people often think, after they leave, okay, I'm supposed to love everybody equally. And there is a sense in which that is true, but not in the context in which I'm speaking. There is an equality in the sense that in a different sense, but treatment. Illustration. We go to the park, and we're going to feed the homeless. Okay? We get out there and we cook up this wonderful meal, and we let it be known, and people start coming to be fed. A child comes. We give him a portion for a child. A large man comes. Do we give him the same portion? No, he needs more for his well-being. So we give him what he needs for his well-being, which is more food than we gave the child. That's impartial treatment. But if we gave the child and the man the same amount of food, that would be equal treatment. But it wouldn't satisfy the needs of the man, and it would be a waste with the child. See that? Marvelous. So God's grace is sufficient for our needs. If we need more, it's sufficient. The person that needs great grace to get out of great sin, it's available. Because that's what he needs. Wonderful, isn't it? Okay. That's impartiality out of this verse. Anybody see any more of impartiality or disinterestedness?
Well, God himself, when he says that he's kind to the ungrateful, so
he's
even to those who should give back, and he knows will not.
Even God himself is impartial. Even God himself gives grace and mercy upon the grateful and ungrateful. And we're to do the same. He appeals even to God's example for us to follow. Yes?
There's also an attribute in here of being ungrateful.
Okay. Okay. Seeks not its own. Willing to suffer loss. Yes?
Verse 35. The statement is just doing good for the sake of doing good in this land, hoping for nothing again. It's almost as if, let me give this, and I hope I don't get anything back. Almost for doing good for the sake of just good alone.
That is the disinterested part. NASB says not hoping but expecting nothing back. The motive is not an expectation of getting something back, which would be an ulterior motive. Okay? But the disinterested part is do, give, bless, not having in your mind an expectation to get something back. And that is the spirit of this world. The sinner always has something coming back to him as his motive. Always. The sinner does nothing for its own sake, just for the sake of the fact that it's good to do. He does it expecting something back.
We have to be sure to understand that not hoping for nothing in return is not looking for that nothing as a reward. I think there might be some need of clarification there, because it seems from the question that they might be looking for that as a reward for what we did, but hoping nothing.
If somebody is thinking as a reward, yes, that would not be the reward, but it's expecting anything in return. Praise? Feeling good? See, selfishness is devotion to the sensibilities to follow them whenever they command, and that's the rule of action, so that through the sensibilities and what one desires, the payoff is, if I do this, I'll get this feeling. I'll get this desire gratified. I'll feel good. I'll be happy. That is expecting something in return. Expecting nothing in return. Love, as Jesus is describing, you do what you do for the sake of the doing of it. The good that you will do. And we'll make a distinction in a bit between doing it because it's right and doing it for the good that it will do. Doing that for the good that we'll do is right. But the object in mind is the good that you will do, not doing something that is right. Love commands us to love our neighbor. The law commands us to love our neighbor, which is to promote their good. The law does not command us to do that which is right. If you accept the notion that the law commands us to do that which is right, then you have to say, what is right? And what is right is to promote my neighbor's well-being for its own sake. That is what's going to be in the mind's eye, in the heart. That is what we'll be committed to in a benevolent person. The good of another, not doing that which is right. because right would have to be defined. Nobody has through their sensibility the sense of right. But everybody has a sense of good. And everybody knows that doing that for another, for its own sake, is right. Okay, we're going to take a break and pick up from here. And we'll start the next session at 1:30.